Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Friday, January 22nd, 2010, I am delighted to welcome Seth Godin, writer, speaker, and agent of change, as well as the author of a new book out Tuesday called Lynchpin, Are You Indispensable? Welcome, Seth.
Hi, Jennifer Lindsay. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for being on the show. Thrilled to have you on. We should say that you can pre-order the book on Amazon.com. And from I was so excited to get a sneak peek at it. I have to say, this, for me, of the books you've written, may be the most important one you've ever written. At one point, you say that it's personal, or this time it's personal. What makes this book different for you?
I get a lot of email, as I'm sure you do, and what I discovered over the last 2 years or so was that the tone of the email was changing. People were writing to me saying that it's just not working for them anymore, that they were doing what they were supposed to do, but they weren't getting what they were supposed to get. They were asking me what's wrong with the system and the deal and the process they bought into. And a lot of my books in the past have been about the system, about how you build an organization or a strategy. And what occurred to me is that the system is broken. It's toast. Put a fork in it, it's done. And that we have entered a new age. And this revolution isn't just a revolution about how to waste time at work, spending time on a social network. It is, in fact, a fundamental revolution, the death of industry. And what this book is about is a personal manifesto for how any individual can view that as an opportunity and contribute their best to what they do every day.
I'm curious if you've seen the new Wired magazine when it talks about the change in workforce. Have you seen that one?
Well, I got one yesterday with Chris Anderson's article about the new industrial revolution, that one.
Yeah. What did you make of that?
Well, everything Chris says is smart and insightful. I did an interview with him a couple weeks ago about this. His argument is that the idea that you can have an entire factory floor on your laptop, creating whatever physical prototype you want, pressing a button, sending it to China, getting it back, and then ordering a lot of them, means that this physical manifestation of industry, the factory, the 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 people in a building, the receptionist in the private parking spaces, and the senior vice president of corporate strategy all go away. And they're replaced by individuals who have something to create and something to say. One of the things they talked about in that article was a car built by committee, but once you get past the caption, it turns out one guy designed this car, a guy who doesn't work for a car company. Now, it may not become as popular as a Chevy Nova, but the fact that one individual with a laptop that you can buy for $900 at Best Buy is able to design a car that's actually going to get built and sold is a stunning testament to the fact that we now live in a really different world.
Absolutely. So it sounds like you're sort of in violent agreement.
Yes. What we do is we write the books that say the same thing, but we don't talk about it until after they're out.
I got it. Well, one of the things that I really liked in the book was a story you tell about Picasso. And I'm not sure actually if this is a true story or an a machination for the purposes of pointing something out. But you want to tell the story and
sure.
I wasn't there. You weren't there. Yeah.
So it might be apocryphal, but here you go. Pablo Picasso is riding on the train in first class, and there's one other person in the car with him, and it's in Spain on the plane. I don't know if it was raining or not. And they're driving along, and finally the other guy in the cab gets up his nerve, and he reaches over and he says, "Are you Pablo Picasso, the great painter?" And Pablo Picasso says, "Yes, that's me." And the guy says, "Well, I love your work. It's a pleasure to meet you. I just need to tell you, though, that my wife has an important question." And Pablo rolls his eyes and says, "What?" She says, "Why do you paint everything so weird? Why can't you just paint the world as it is?" And Pablo looks at him and says, your wife said this? What's she look like? And the guy reaches into his pocket and pulls out a picture and hands it to him and says, here, this is my wife. And Pablo looks at the picture and says, that's your wife? She's very small and flat, too. Bada boom. The point of the story is that Picasso saw the world as he saw it. He painted the world as he saw it. And a photograph is the same thing. It's not reality. What we do for a living is transform the environment we're in, the phone call we're on, the project we're working on, the thing we're building, transform it by adding our personality, transform it by adding our perception to it. And if for a living all you do is follow a manual, flip a burger, do what you're told, and wait for instructions, then guess what? You're not worth very much, because I can find someone to do what you just did cheaper. And the economy that we live in now is harsh, because every chance it gets to find someone cheaper, it does.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one point I like that you make in the book is that you are a genius. You know, almost everybody's had, you know, you have a few questions here, but almost everybody solved a problem that confounded their family. Almost everybody's, you know, found a way to make something work that wasn't working before, or made a connection to someone out of reach to everyone else. If we're a collective source of genius in different areas, what does that mean the future looks like? So if people take the message of your book to heart, which is you're worth more than you're trading yourself in for with corporate America, what does that mean the world looks like?
Well, you know, one thing you could do is take this to an extreme and say, what happens when everyone starts acting like an artist? You know, don't we need some people to pack boxes filled with that popcorn packing corn? Don't we need some people to sweep the streets and dig ditches? And the answer is sure we do, but it doesn't have to be you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not under the illusion that every single person in the world is going to read my book and change what they do and who they are. I do believe that there are millions of people who bought into a lie, who have been brainwashed into thinking they have no right to do great work. And the magic of what the Internet has done by giving you a laptop, by giving you professional tools, by connecting you to the world, is no one can say no anymore. You got a book to write? Write it. You have a song to sing? Sing it. You have a product to design, a car to make? Go ahead and make it. No one can stop you. So what we're going to find are organizations filled with people doing this, a culture where that's what's supposed to happen. And we're also going to find struggling, stuck, slow companies that insist on being filled with cogs who are compliant, and those companies will be effortlessly defeated by the new ones.
So one thing that I think about when I think about the economy today is how a lot of people are realizing, some for the first time, that, you know, companies aren't loyal, that they, you know, they'll go for the best deal. You're totally and completely replaceable. But I also think about my mother, who worked for Bank of America for 22 years or something insane like that, did her job every day. And when Security Pacific Bank Bank of America bought them, I can't remember exactly what happened, but anyway, there was a merging of these two companies. She was suddenly out of a job and tried a bunch of jobs, but I kept saying, go back to school, do something else to be passionate, and she did. She found a second career as a social worker, but not many people follow that mold where they go, okay, well, I'm just going to, you know, do what I think is right and do what's, you know, or have support to say, you know, someone's there to you know, do what's right for me. But what kind of confounds me is people seem to have forgotten that happened before. I mean, for most Generation Xers, I thought that, you know, I'm starting to hear the message, I guess, more and more, and there's this underlying theme in the book that you can't really trust corporate America because they see us all as replaceable to an extent. And I think, you know, I guess my question is, why now? Why is it, it seems to be dawning on many more people now in a new way.
Well, there's a few factors at work. Factor number one is that business consumers, corporations that buy stuff, and consumers have discovered that you can type any item you want into Google and find it cheaper somewhere else. So geography is no longer a buffer. It doesn't permit a local vendor to extract extra revenue to treat its employees better, because you're selfish. You don't care. You'll just go to Walmart. You'll just click a few buttons and buy your bumper stickers in Iowa instead of down the street. Right? I mean, everyone does that. Number two is that the Internet also makes it much easier for corporations to find suppliers who are cheaper. So if I look at something like Mechanical Turk, or you want someone to transcribe something, you find it online. You don't buy it from that person you always counted on, because it's too easy to find a replacement. Number three, internationalization means that you might do a fine job making those stereo speakers, but if someone in China can make those stereo speakers for 10% what you're making them for, it doesn't matter what else is true. You're in trouble. And so what's happened is the world got flat really fast. And this flatness is punishing people who weren't as good at being cogs in the system as other people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we leave out the part that someone's really kind, or we leave out the part that someone's recovering from cancer, or we leave out the part that they've been working here for 22 years, because the only alternative, we think, is we're going to go out of business. And so my argument is, if all you do is make something to spec, you're doomed. If you follow a manual, you're doomed. That the only niche available is to do things that only you could do, to do things that involve connection, and to do things that involve leadership, and to do things that involve creativity and inventing what to do next. Those people, not only aren't they doomed, there's a line out their door of people waiting to hire them, because that's what we're willing to pay for. You either race to the bottom and get smushed, or you race to the top and you win.
Talk about the resistance of our lizard brains.
Well,
I'm not sure I can do it justice.
The good question, which you're implying, is if this is so important, why doesn't everyone do it? If there's so much value and joy to be found, why doesn't everyone do it? And the answer was first described by Steve Pressfield in a book called The War of Art. And then I connected it to something called Triune Theory about the prehistoric brainstem amygdala region of the back of your brain. That's the brain that's called the lizard brain. It's the brain of the chicken, the brain of the dinosaur, that little piece of your brain that's responsible for survival and revenge and anger and reproduction and fear. That's the part that keeps you safe from saber-toothed tigers. It's the lizard brain that gets really upset when you want to give a speech because people might laugh at you. It's the lizard brain that keeps you from raising your hand because you learned in school that every time you raise your hand, you run the risk of getting in trouble. And we have brainwashed people into amplifying their lizard brain. Now, when there were saber-toothed tigers and we lived on the savanna, listening to your lizard brain was very smart because it kept you alive. But now, listening to your lizard brain gets you a job sweeping the floors of, you know, the car dealership because you're afraid to do anything but follow instructions. So a third of my book is about giving a name to the resistance, teaching you, you know, one of the great riffs came from Elizabeth Gilbert, and I twisted it a little, but basically she said, have you noticed that people get writer's block, but no one gets plumber's block? You know, the plumber doesn't come to your house and say, you know, I just don't feel like unplugging your toilet. Do you have some scotch, some whiskey, right?
Yeah.
We sort of accept that it's okay to get writer's block. It's not. We get paid to write now. We get paid to invent. We get paid to be inspired. We get paid to connect. And if the lizard brain shows up, we have to show it the door.
Got it. And that's, I mean, it's that internal struggle of, you know, not being a cog in the wheel, I guess, that, you know, is the interesting part, you know, and how to make that mental shift is almost something I can imagine somebody being in therapy for years to try to overcome. But I guess, you know, my question is for those people that really, one thing I want to ask you about is there's the section where you talk about giving, receiving, giving, that we're kind of wired to give things. Or that's how I've taken it to mean.
There's two bits of wiring that go on. There's the reciprocity thing, which says that if you get something, you should pay for it, that we should be even Steven, that there should be no debts outstanding at the end of the day. And we have built an entire culture on this retail mindset. Artists, the kind of people who make change, the kind of people who make a difference, can't abide that, because when you make a transaction, it pushes you away from the person you transacted with. It doesn't get you closer to them because there's no obligation left. And what artists do is we give gifts. Artists don't want to be pushed away. We want to be made closer. So if you go to talk about painting as an artist, if you go to the museum and you see a Chuck Close painting or a Shepard Fairey painting on the wall, you don't have to pay the artist to see it. And if you turn on the radio, you don't have to pay Paul McCartney to hear his gift. That there's generous component to art. It's the extra part that you didn't pay for that makes it powerful. So if you're on an airplane and the pilot treats your kid better than you expected, you don't have to pay extra for that. If you're on Twitter and you ask for help and someone shows up and just tells you what to do, that's free, right? It's a gift that binds the giver to the recipient, and that's what artists seek out. This and the magic of the internet is it's easier to be generous on the internet than anywhere else.
True, but one of the things about the internet is something we just talked about, where we can buy goods and services from places that, you know, may not have the same, or may not have, you know, we can basically flip our thinking in terms of, you know, making price the most important thing when it comes to goods and services, rather than a mixture of price and ethics, let's say, if it's buying from China. How do you square those two pieces of the pie?
Well, that's the tricky line that we're going to walk for a long time. So Cory Doctorow has posted, 50,000 blog posts on Boing Boing in the last 10 years. If you're going to buy a science fiction novel and all other things are equal, you're going to buy Cory's because you have a connection. You owe him. And if Cory says, you know, there's this great art show, I think you should go look at it, you'll go look at it. He's earned the right. That when a product is undifferentiated, we're almost always going to buy the cheap one. But what can differentiate it is that someone you care about signed it or made it by hand or endorsed it or it helps a cause that's important to you emotionally. Because the purchases we're going to make that aren't the cheap ones, that aren't Walmart quality purchases, are going to be purchases we make for emotional reasons, not for reasons we can put in a spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm. And really what we're talking about is sort of defining ourselves as more, or embracing a more emotional part of ourselves, isn't it?
And being human, right? One of the reasons the lizard brain really likes manuals and really likes rules and really likes saying, that's not my job, is because then it's not responsible. It doesn't want to be blamed. So if you're standing there saying, look, I feel really badly for you, but it's not my job, I'm not allowed to change this, well, then the lizard brain is safe. But if you're human, if you stand up and say, I wrote this, I designed this, I said this, then people might laugh at you, and that's our nightmare. But what we're discovering, particularly in social media, is it gives people a chance to be human again. Now, I am appalled, as I think you are, when corporations step into social media and are acting as this hybrid person/corporation because they want all the benefits of connection and they don't want any of the responsibility of connection. Mm. And that, I think, is a huge mistake.
Yeah, we just talked. Brian Solis was one of the people on a panel this week that I moderated, and he said something about, you know, most companies that he works with don't want to be transparent and they don't want to be authentic. And so I asked him before he even finished, I said, does that mean that they're working in social media then? You know, because, I mean, those are the cornerstones, right? So,
right.
You know, I work with a lot of companies that maybe don't fit the bill, but I try to at least couch it in a way so that I feel like I'm getting them closer to that, rather than just saying they're never going to be that way and this is the way it is.
Right, and I guess what I'm arguing is Close works in dancing and hand grenades, but it's not good enough here. That
right.
The corporations of the future are the ones where every transaction is an opportunity to give a gift, an opportunity for generosity, an opportunity for humanity. And if you know, when Frank started tweeting at Comcast, his original work before it got into the system was magnificent, because here was this juxtaposition between this faceless, horrible, evil corporation and one guy in his pajamas, in his spare time, tweeting you on Sunday morning trying to get your cable box up so you could watch the Super Bowl. I mean, that, the stunning difference between the two is why it worked, right?
Mm.
But once Frank has a team of 26 people and they're reading the tweets off a manual and copying and pasting and they're just trying to get through them all, it's not working anymore, because now it's just another form of operators are standing by, your call is very important to us, but due to unusually heavy call volume.
Yeah, exactly. So have you heard Loic Lemire, the founder of Seismic and co-dude at LaWeb, basically the guy that talks the entire time and runs the sessions, told he's got this famous line, something about, you know, if you have a PR company, fire them and do it yourself. And really does not believe in PR companies, because he thinks you can't, that's not how business is done anymore. And people are, think it's the most provocative thing in the world. And I'm just wondering, you know, kind of what your take is on that.
Well, understand there's a big difference between publicity and public relations.
Mm-hmm.
Public relations, when done properly, is the art of living and of crafting and then living a story that's true, right? It's a whole strategy about going to market and talking about that. That's essential. It's more important than ever before. Publicity is another word for spamming people. And he and I couldn't agree more. Why are you spamming people even if they're journalists? That doesn't give you the right to spam them. Get rid of those people. It's a mistake that if anyone is going to talk about you, they're going to talk about you. And I'm making a big exception for things like Hollywood movies. But for general products, if anyone's going to talk about you, it's because they like you, believe in you, care about you, want you to succeed, and you've made a connection to them. And that doesn't get done by a publicity firm. It gets done by human beings.
So one question I have is, if everybody takes to their computers and starts writing, Rafe Needleman from CBS Interactive, formerly CNET, or maybe he's still at CNET. I'm not sure what they're calling themselves these days, but he was on the panel that I moderated this week as well. And, you know, I think, you know, there was a lot of discussion about, and I went to Columbia Journalism School, so, you know, this is sort of, I am very invested in the future of journalism, and we know the newspaper system's broken, and there's talk of pay models or some pay models that are happening. And one thing we talked about is something that comes up in this book, which is, you know, if you're an artist and the thing you do is write, take to your keyboard and write. So what Rafe's question was, and what I'll pose to you, is how does he or someone like him get paid?
Okay, well, he may not like this, but let me try to do this quickly. One of the best obituaries that ever ran in the New York Times was by Douglas Martin, and it was about a woman who died a few years ago. She was the last rain queen of South Africa. Her daughter had died before her, so the lineage ended after thousands of years. This woman made relative riches, fortune, because people came to her to make it rain. You used to be able to make a lot of money as a weatherman, because there weren't very many weathermen. Now,
right.
I think we can all agree that if you work for the National Weather Service or just repurpose the weather, anyone can do that.
Right.
That doesn't mean we're running out of weather. It just means it's not a great profession anymore. It used to be you could make money as a poet. Not a lot, but you could. Now, everyone's a poet. No one makes money doing it, but we're not running out of poetry. I don't think we're going to run out of the kind of stuff Rafe writes. In fact, I think there's more of the stuff Rafe writes than ever before. So if we're not going to have a shortage and there's more people making it than ever before, guess what, Rafe? We're not going to pay you to do what you did, because that was an artificial scarcity, and it's over now. That doesn't mean there isn't a way for really insightful people to get paid. But what you're going to get paid for if you deliver information is either it's going to be faster than everybody else. That's how Bloomberg makes billions of dollars a year.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's more personal and customized than anybody else's from someone I trust more. I'd pay for that too, and so would you. But mm-hmm. if you're just giving me one more person's take on the Apple tablet, thank you very much. I don't need to hear it. I don't need to pay for that.
Which, by the way, hasn't been announced yet. So I guess we're all thinking the same thing, I guess, about next week. So it's going to be kind of anticlimactic, I think.
Yeah, my version of next week is when my book comes out. Oh, and by the way, they're launching the tablet.
Oh, no. You're on my show early, so you get the Friday before, man, the Friday before. Now, one thing I want to ask you about, too, is, and this is something that I've long talked about, and we didn't get to talk much before the call, but I think it bothers me to a certain extent that people, I find in this country especially, are so defined by what they do for a job, what they
mm-hmm.
do for money.
Yep.
How does that fit in with the overall, you know, points of departure in the book, the larger points that you're making?
Well, one of the things I say in the book is you are not your resume and you are not your job. What you are is your work. The work is the stuff that scares you. The work is the stuff you leave behind. The work is the stuff with your name on it. Whether or not you get paid for the work is irrelevant. You know, everyone needs to eat. I get that. But what I'm going to hire you for, what I'm going to honor you for, is the work you did. So when I meet somebody at a cocktail party and I say, what do you do? What are you working on? I don't care who pays them. I care what is the act that you did yesterday that you're proud of. And I think that we need to get away from this idea that you punched a clock and therefore got a check and that's interesting. It's not. What's interesting is the impact you're making on the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that sort of giving it back piece that makes, your blog posts really resonant. Even though they tend to be pretty short, you can get a really powerful message across. It doesn't take a ton of words to do that. And I think that's a really powerful thing. And I hope people take that away, that getting away from defining ourselves by either what we do for a living and have suppressed and haven't been doing, but actually read this book and take time to think about what their passions are. And that's one thing I wanted to kind of leave folks with, because one thing I have found, I have a brother-in-law that's been out of work for some time. So, you know, and I've tried to gently chat with him about it, but what I get is a sense, maybe, and this is more than just him, but in general, is that, you know, with all the opportunities that abound on the net and, you know, they have access to the best computers and all of that, so it's not like he couldn't take to writing a blog or doing something like that, and he loves baseball and that kind of thing. You know, people just don't. It's almost like they're not inspired or it hasn't dawned on them. What do you say to those people? Do you think you're going to be able to reach those people? And how important is it that we reach those folks?
Well, the first thing I'd say is he's not out of work. He's out of a job. Two different things. And
yeah,
I'd love for him to be back in work. I think he should set up an eBay account and start selling baseball memorabilia. He should figure out how to put himself in the center of some circle or the leadership of some tribe. He should build a Ning group for free and assemble the unassembled. And this is free, and it's fast, and it's scary, but it's not difficult. And he needs to scare himself. Now, what I set myself out to do as a writer is intentionally not please everyone. If I try to please everyone, I will fail. Who am I trying to please? Who am I trying to change? Well, you know, it would be a good thing if I could change some of my existing fans. It would be a great thing if I gave them a tool they could hand to your brother-in-law and say, this self-contained piece of dead wood, if you took it away for 2 days, maybe, could change the way you think. And if I could do that for 3 people a week, it would make me happy.
So I guess we're about out of time, but one last question I always like to ask authors. You dedicated the book to Helene. Who's Helene?
That's my wife.
Aw, isn't that sweet? That's a lovely little note to end on. That's good. That was a nice little warm thought. I like that. In any event, thank you so much for being on the program.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for
doing this. I could ask Yeah, I could ask you questions for days. Go out and pre-order Linchpin. You can do so from our Blog Talk Radio page. But thank you. I'll let you get on with your day and your web tour.
We'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
That was Seth Godin, folks.
You are so good. You're a professional. It was a pleasure. I have a 3:30. I got to run. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was Seth Godin there with us here on the A-List. I hope that you enjoyed the program. If so, we'd love it if you'd be so kind as to friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to tune in 1 week from today. And more than anything, please participate in the conversation. You can certainly ask any question you want of anybody we're going to have on the show or just in general about the show by tweeting in. My Twitter account is Jennifer with an ED on the end, Jennifered. And as always, you can keep up with the latest on this show and much more at jenniferlindsay.com. I wish you all a wonderful weekend. Thank you.